This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Sorry about the sound of my voice today. I'm just recovering from a cold. April 12th marks the first anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray, a young African-American man in Baltimore, Maryland, who was brutally arrested by police and who died in custody. Gray's death sparked weeks of rioting in what became known as the Baltimore Uprising. Several officers are currently on trial for Gray's death. Baltimore is marked by its proximity to power. It is only 40 miles from the nation's capital, and its pockets of extreme poverty concentrated in, and it has pockets of extreme poverty concentrated in African-American neighborhoods. Studying this in a newly published book is my guest, Stephanie DeLuca. She's an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and she and her co-authors, Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden, spent more than 10 years interviewing and researching 150 Black Baltimore youth who were born in the late 1980s and early 1990s and who lived in the city's public housing projects. They wrote a book about it called Coming of Age in the Other America. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Stephanie DeLuca.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we get into your book and the specific topic, the research that you spent 10 years doing, let's talk about the Freddie Gray moment in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. When Freddie Gray died in police custody almost a year ago, how did you understand his death and also the community's response to it?
So I remember that there were a lot of things were happening at once. But I will just say to you, my first impression was I was on the east side of the city coming back, and it was really quiet. And then I was in the central part of the city and the south part of the city, and it was really quiet. And I kept seeing on Twitter and on the web that there were, you know, riots and all of this. And it turned out that there was a very small section of the city where, you know, there had been some looting and some violence. And so the first impression I had was that the media was blowing up the story into one where the city was in chaos. And so that was sort of an interesting entree into what would happen over the next few weeks, which is the way that the media portrayed Baltimore and Baltimore's youth. I think the second thing that really struck me about this period was the fact that that no one really knew what happened at Mondawmin Mall. Okay. And this is, I'm focusing more on the unrest after the death, because a lot of what came out about how people were thinking and feeling it took a couple more days for that to come out. And after the funeral. And so, I think that there was an incredible lack of information about what had caused the Mondawmin incident, where youth were on their way home from school and then were met with the phalanx of police officers. And then, a number of stories got spun after that. And I found myself for a few weeks trying to provide a corrective narrative for Baltimore as a city and its youth.
So tell us about the research that you and your coworkers did, because that research probably informed what you were feeling last year. You spoke with 150 Black kids in Baltimore. This happened over 10 years. How did you identify who to talk to, and what sort of things were you looking for to study in a city like Baltimore?
So we never anticipated that we would be writing a book on the transition to adulthood for Baltimore's youth, or that it would be such a timely, become such a timely topic. So we started the work in 2003 because Baltimore was one site of a major federal housing experiment called Moving to Opportunity. So in the, by the time the early 90s came around, the scholarship and journalism and public policy conversation was one of, the perils, of inner city concentrated poverty and its devastating effects on families and children. And so there were sort of two big responses at that point. The National Commission on Severely Distressed Housing came out in 92, suggesting that we really had to think about the fact that we were unable to provide safe and decent housing for many of our low-income families. And so the federal government decided to first demolish large portions of the housing stock, the most distressed and most violent, The second was the launch of a federal housing experiment to give families a chance to move out of public housing with special vouchers through the Moving to Opportunity program. So a lot was happening at this time when in the mid-90s. And so by the early 2000s, there was some early research on the Moving to Opportunity experiment, looking at what happened when families left public housing. The results were quite mixed and surprising. You know, it looked like there were no positive effects for mothers' income and employment. Boys seemed to be doing worse, but girls seemed to be behaving better, and mothers' mental health improved. So there were some confusing results, you know, no education gains. And so we went into the field in 2003 to try to understand some of those confusing findings. And, you know, because the conventional wisdom at that time was if families can leave high-rise public housing, their lives should get better. And in some ways, they absolutely did. And in others, it took some time for this to unfold and for us to really learn what happened. So the first wave was us going out into the neighborhoods, trying to talk to families and children and some teachers to see what had happened.
How deeply embedded is poverty in Baltimore, a city that's so close to Washington, D.C.? I think that's an important context to bring up. Mm-hmm. You know, for people who have never been to Baltimore or who might only have been to those parts of Baltimore that are upscale, there, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like a tale of two cities, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's also a tale of a wealthy region and a beleaguered city, right? So, you know, Baltimore, the east and west sides of Baltimore have been since the 1930s, you know, racially segregated, mostly African-American parts of the city, you know, and then when the public housing projects were sited on either side of downtown in East and West Baltimore, then poverty also became more concentrated. And then, you know, a familiar story to some other American cities, you know, by the 60s, you know, middle-class families and many white families had started to leave after the 1968 riots, after MLK's death, you know, which led to, you know, what became a quite a bit big population loss for Baltimore of, you know, many middle-class residents and, you know, and the segregation and concentrated poverty only increased on these, you know, two sides of the city right around downtown, while the north and central neighborhoods were, you know, where Hopkins is and further north remained white and wealthy. And then by the time, you know, roughly the late 90s, early 2000s, there was some revitalization in South Baltimore and neighborhoods like Canton, Federal Hill, Mount Vernon, which started to, you know, give the city a rebirth. The Inner Harbor, right under Rouse, was renovated and was national, you know, became internationally famous. Meanwhile, you know, our poorest neighborhoods with mostly minority families were largely left to languish. And so, you know, problems became more severe there and still more, you know, as you said, were separated from the rest of the city.
So let's talk about some of your research findings. In terms of the school life of the kids that you research, you identify these so-called identity projects in your research. What are these and how do they impact the lives of the kids?
So I'd have to say, you know, to start out with, we were, you know, when we went back into the field 7 years after our first wave of data collection and started spending time with the youth who were 0 to 10 when they were, you know, in the housing projects at the beginning of the original intervention, were now 15 to 24 years old. We went out to see what it was like for them as they became young adults and started launching their own lives. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a story about neighborhoods and this is a story about disadvantage. And yet in the field work, you know, in the interviews, and when we went back to the stories and the data, there was this incredible resilience, passion, you know, this wellspring of motivation, you know, and grit that was coming off the pages through the voices of these youth. And we remembered, you know, thinking at when we were doing the interviews, wow, you know, Bob was really into Japanese, you know, animation, and Bridget was really avidly into dancing, and it was all she could talk about. And, you know, Vicky couldn't stand still in the interview before she said, look, I've got to take you outside and show you my pigeons. And so there was this sort of inner life of the inner city that just jumped out. And it was one of the, you know, welcome surprises of doing the work. We then said, let's take a look at all the data and what, you know, where, what are these hobbies and interests? And they seem to be really important. And so we looked across all of the data and identified that about half the youth in our sample had what we called an identity project, and about half didn't. And there was a very strong relationship between those who had identity projects and the youth who, you know, finished high school, entered college, and were by 2010 at least employed or in school.
So basically a kind of a passion. These are kids who found a passion in something, could be anything, but just a passion for something.
And right. And we, you know, as we dug more deeply, you know, to try to figure out, is this different from just, you know, entertainment, or is this just different from, you know, from school? I think what we saw a couple of different things. We saw about three different types. One we call kind of the do-it-yourself identity project, which is often a private escape from difficult things, you know, family chaos and conflict, you know, difficult times. You know, these youth were experiencing an incredible amount of trauma, even, you know, years later after having, you know, left the projects. And some of these DIY identity projects were like Vicky's pigeon coop building, you know, she did in the backyard that she started doing with her dad. It was kind of her refuge, her escape. Dana, you know, would sit in her bedroom with the door closed, get her dad's video camera on and start, you know, just stream of consciousness talking and, you know, reciting some of her poetry and talking about difficulties. And she called it Dana's TV show. So these were sort of the more private escape identity projects that provided sustenance and sort of a sense of integrity, you know, in an often chaotic world. The second kind we noticed were more sort of peer culture, subculture, hobbies and art, you know, interests that one could share with peers. Like, you know, Bob became very involved in these, Magic the card, you know, the Gathering card game, Pokemon, and the Japanese anime. And this created a subgroup of youth who were trying to be academically engaged, but were finding it hard, you know, to separate themselves and not get picked on. And they just really bonded together over these unique, not typically interests that Black youth in Baltimore were engaging in. And just sort of, as Bob put it, said, you know, we were different and we didn't fit in. And in some ways that not fitting in is what really helped us get through school. The third kind, you know, which we call the sort of institutionally supported identity project, there are things like the junior ROTC, this police explorers program, you know, a business academy inside of a high school, community theater, so some of it's more vocational programming, at a youth opportunity center, something that has a support so that activities are structured, there's community, and many of these activities that actually then can link to future, post-secondary education or job interests, and gave youth a really strong sense of what they were about. You know, Cody would wear his police explorer's badge and say, you know, I'm proud to be a police explorer. So there were definitely these different sort of types of identity projects.
And you found that those kids who did have those versus kids who didn't did significantly better in terms of staying at school, in terms of graduating, in terms of maybe finding a job, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, we loosely call it being on track. You know, by 2010, were youth either in school or employed or both, you know, which characterized actually over 80% of our youth, which is one of the big surprises in the study as well. There were, fewer than one out of five youth were what we call disconnected. And what we noticed is, that one of the strongest predictors of being on track was having an identity project. Right. And the institutionally supported identity projects seem to have the strongest effect of keeping kids on course. And part of the reason we think this happens is not only is this just meaningful and fun, and something to be about. Everybody wants that, right? These youth are hungry, looking for something to be about. But it also, sparks and inspires the gritty behaviors that are required to stay the course. You know, this grit conversation was getting really popular, the last few years. And we sort of argue in the book that grit doesn't just show up out of nowhere. It needs to be inspired. And that's sort of another interesting thing that we think is behind the identity projects.
And what is what role does the issue of housing play? You referred to it earlier, but housing, of course, is one of the most important things when it comes to families, stability, staying together. How hard is it to afford housing in Baltimore? And second, through your research, what did you find out about how where you live defines how your life turns out in the city?
Yeah. I'll take the sort of the second question first. I think that right about now, we've got 30 years of social science research that is pointing to one very clear and compelling fact, which is it's not just the family you grow up in that determines your fate, but the neighborhood. The neighborhood you grew up in, and not just the family you're born into.
And in a way, Freddie Gray's fate was determined by where he lived, right?
Yeah, it's shaped is probably the word I would use. You know, I think there's always a combination of family, school, and neighborhood. But what we're starting to see, and this was clear in some recent research that Raj Chetty, Larry Katz, and Nathan Hendren had done on the Moving to Opportunity study, which our book was born out of. They looked across the five cities at the youth who left the high poverty neighborhoods with the MTO vouchers as they, about 20 years later, as they became adults with IRS data, and were finding large gains in earnings, college attendance, marriage, and really big gains, big dividends to escaping concentrated poverty. We've started to see a convergence of this evidence, which is, really encouraging in that it tells us we've got one really, we've identified an active, important ingredient that's a policy lever that we can do something about. And in our book, we talk about the fact that, while there was heterogeneity, differences in how youth turned out at the brink of adulthood, if we step back and just look at all of the youth in our study and compare them to their parents, we saw huge intergenerational gains, across the board. So, only about a quarter of the parents of the youth in our study had finished high school. 6% got GEDs. So this is about a third had a high school credential, and over 70% of the youth in our study had managed to complete high school.
Wow. So that's pretty significant. Want to remind our audience that I'm speaking with Stephanie DeLuca, and we're talking about her book, Coming of Age in the Other America. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're going to keep Stephanie on with us for an extended interview that you can hear on our website and watch on our website. Again, that's risingupwithsonali.com. Stephanie, in your book, you bring up an essay that a white resident of Baltimore named Tracy Halverson wrote during last year's uprising called Baltimore City, You're Breaking My Heart. And in it, she sort of, in a sincere way, tried to point out how the youth of Baltimore were kind of freaking her out, that she looked as if she felt like she was prey. What did this essay represent in terms of relations between Baltimore's white and black residents?
So what's really interesting, actually, is the essay came out a year before the unrest.
Oh, really?
I remember, say, about maybe February, March of 2014. And what's telling about that, right, is that these issues were, were part of the bedrock of what was going on in Baltimore, that this tension between, residents in some of the more affluent white neighborhoods that were butting up against or, near some higher poverty neighborhoods. So I think that I remember being incredibly moved by the piece and immediately thought, wow, this doesn't represent what we're seeing in our study, which is the same thing I felt when watching the media coverage of the unrest. It's a very narrow slice, very narrow portrayal of youth in Baltimore as thugs, threats, right? And what you see often, you know, with some coverage of these types of things is a focus on the most publicly aggravating, threatening, images of inner city life. And when you focus on that, what you miss is everybody else who's in the house doing homework, at work, training for dance or football, or doing a whole bunch of other things, which it turns out was more than 80% of the youth in our study. You know, and I think that on the one hand, you know, there's certainly, it's worth paying attention to the most troubled youth and, and violent crime. I think that the risk you run with essays like that in certain kinds of quick turnaround media coverage is that the extreme, you know, the exception becomes the norm. And that doesn't help us, right? It continues to make us think, well, those kids are threats to us and our kids, right? So I think that's why, as sociologists, we wanted to really put a more balanced view out there. It wasn't their delinquent behavior that got these youth in our study. It was their shared origins. And what we see is there's quite a bit of variation in how they end up at the brink of adulthood.
What about relations between the Black community and police, which is, of course, a really important issue? You mentioned that some of the kids in your study were in ROTC, and that was actually a good thing for them. But in their day-to-day life, did you notice interactions with police that had detrimental effects on kids? Did they talk about it? Was it something you even studied?
So, it came up, we asked, explicitly about it, because it was, when we started our study, there were still quite a few families living in public housing, and there was a lot of concentration of police attention in some of these complexes, and it was sort of, it's, if you live in Baltimore, right, I mean, you can sort of feel it's present in all neighborhoods on the East and West Side where we were spending time. So we definitely asked about it. But it wasn't an overwhelming story across the board. It wasn't anything we focused on in the book, even because it wasn't the story that we were hearing over and over again. But what we did hear from those youth who, especially the young men, of course, was this sort of frustration, and a sense that, they could clearly say there are some good cops and some bad cops. We know some are trying to do their jobs, but, I can't even walk through my neighborhood without getting stopped and say, man, I live here. And what was really interesting is we had a couple of young men in the study. One I mentioned earlier was part of the Police Explorers program, and he would wear his badge. Another young man, Antonio, worked as a Hopkins security guard, and he wore his badge. Another young man named Gary worked as a GNA, at a facility for older folks. And he always wore his scrubs and badge when he came in and out of the neighborhood, because when police would pull them over, right, they would say, look, I'm a working man. I'm not the suspect, right? I'm wearing a badge. I'm wearing a work uniform. There was sort of this really heartbreaking
aspect. He had to keep proving himself and his innocence.
Yeah. And, and this is, right, I think, in some ways, right, some of these activities were identity projects that were already helping these young men, aim for a brighter future. But there was also a protective effect. The guy in the blue jeans, the baggy jeans and the white T-shirt, well, it's not you because you're wearing a uniform. I mean, that came through quite a bit. But we did hear of some traumatic interactions with police. A lot of it was just the capriciousness, feeling always targeted. We went back actually last summer and did a rapid turnaround research project supported in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the 21st Century Cities Initiative at Hopkins to talk to youth in the wake of the unrest in Penn North, Sandtown, and Upton, some of the neighborhoods right around, where a lot of the unrest was happening, and ask them about, what they were thinking about their city. And we're working right now on a brief that we'll release soon. But one of the things that came through there too is, they said, hey, look, we think this isn't even about race, because so many of the police are African-American. We feel like it's about power, and that, there are lots of places where people don't want us to be.
And then also is the underlying issue and the overarching issue, poverty. Right. I mean, in the end, the social class combined with the race of these young kids, the poverty and the fact that as poor Black kids, they are seen a certain way, they are tracked in a certain direction, it seems to be what impacts our lives more than anything else.
Right. And, you know, and it's interesting to go back to the Halverson essay, the Baltimore You're Breaking My Heart essay. There were a few responses written by other city residents that said, you know, listen, this is about poverty. This isn't even about crime, right? This goes back to this being about poverty. And, you know, and I would argue, and this relates to the earlier question about housing, you know, when we think about root causes, right, of this, you know, correlated, compounded disadvantage, we go back to the fact that Baltimore, you know, at the turn of the 20th century was the nation's pioneer in legalized racial residential segregation. Baltimore was the first city to say it's illegal to move to a block where you're not already in the majority, right? I mean, so you had this sort of formalized segregation, right, compounded with then, you know, lending patterns, redlining, the siting of public housing projects and only, you know, already disadvantaged segregated neighborhoods. You know, so there were, you know, federal housing policies that contributed to this. And in addition to, you know, private sector activity, you know, whites avoiding some of these neighborhoods, blockbusting, you know, landlords and property owners scaring middle-class residents in West Baltimore, right? So this all sort of continued all the way through to, you know, the Wells Fargo case in Baltimore, where, you know, Wells Fargo was sued for, you know, essentially wealth stripping, you know, West Baltimore by, you know, with predatory lending schemes. So housing and the siting of housing and it's a very deep part of this story that I can't overemphasize. Mm.
Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of the insights from your book. Of course, we can get to all of it, but people can pick up a copy of your book, Coming of Age in the Other America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. We've been discussing her new book, Coming of Age in the Other America. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.